Hello and welcome to the Ontology Summit 2014, Track C on Overcoming Ontology Engineering Bottlenecks. This is session two of this track, co-championed by Matthew West, Pascal Hitzler, and myself, Christoph Janowitz. This is March 20th, 2014. I hope you are all on slide one now of the chair zero deck. Now, if we move over to slide two, which is the Overcoming Ontology Engineering Bottlenecks slide, you will see our core mission, namely to identify bottlenecks that hinder the large-scale development and reusage of ontologies and to identify ways to overcome these bottlenecks. Last time, we talked about especially patterns as one of the aspects to do so. This time, some of the bottlenecks that you will hear be discussed by our speakers include social, cultural, and motivational issues, as well as parts of the ontology engineering process that are particularly time-consuming, for instance, because they need multiple iterations. You also see that we discussed some potential solutions. You will find all the details if you follow the tiny link at the very bottom of slide two. Some of the proposed solutions we will discuss this time include lessons learned from the wide adoption of ontologies, as well as the question how to identify purpose-driven modeling granularities that carry sufficient semantics without running into the danger of over-engineering. Let's move on to slide three now. This slide is supposed to give you a very brief overview of interesting questions that we hope we will address today with the help of the three speakers we have, but also with the help of the joint discussion in the chat. Please make sure to use the chat during the presentations, and I'm sure the speakers and also we as co-champions will react to them and also make sure that we get all your feedback for the final summit. What are some of those questions that we hope to address? Well, I hope that we will learn some lessons from in the wild, so to speak, usage of ontologies and especially about the ontology engineering process. We will especially today hear about motivational and cultural issues and also how they balance in terms of tool support. So what is really the bottleneck here? Is it more motivational and cultural issues or more the lack of tools? We will also learn about how to get community buy-in. This is a continuously coming up issue that we discussed multiple times now. We will also learn about the trade-off between explicitness and pragmatics. So that's one block of questions that I hope we will hear about and answer or discuss today. The next one is more focused on crowdsourcing and including the general public. So who will do all those ontologies besides a small set of domain experts? And we will also probably touch a little bit on aspects of quality control, which is still an underdeveloped topic, but a good continuation of our last session, session one, of the bottleneck track. And finally, we will also talk, as briefly mentioned before, about the industry perspective. So what are the current technological solutions available on the market today to overcome ontology engineering bottlenecks? How is the industry dealing with that? And this is, I think, a very interesting question as well. How much, you know, deep semantifications do customers really request? If you move over to slide four now, this is the slide called Speakers. We have three excellent speakers: Oscar Corchi from the Universidad Politécnica de Madrid, Deval Taka from the University of Leeds, and Johannes Thrame as a replacement for Peter Haase from the Fluid Drops operations. So we will start with Oscar Corchi. Each presenter has about 20 minutes. Please keep in mind to advance the slides by saying on which slide you are, ideally maybe also including the title. As you know, you can contribute via the chat, and at the very end, we will have about 30 minutes left for a joint discussion session where you can either use the chat or raise your hand and then unmute and use voice. Okay, so let's get started with Oscar. Oscar will talk about 10 basic rules to overcome ontology engineering deadlocks in collaborative ontology engineering tasks. For those of you who don't know Oscar, Oscar is an associate professor at the Department of Artificial Intelligence at the University Politécnica de Madrid. He is, I would say, one of the leading thinkers and practitioners in the European ontology engineering community and well recognized for his early papers and books on ontology engineering. But these days, he's especially also interested in semantic e-science and big data integration. Welcome, Oscar. We are looking forward to your presentation.
Okay. Thanks very much for the presentation, Christoph. I think that, I mean, I will start, first of all, probably even apologizing for just letting you know that this is the first time that I try to do this type of presentation without seeing the actual faces of people, which is always a little bit difficult, just to know whether, I mean, you are actually, like, following everything that I'm saying or not, but I hope that, I mean, it will be useful for everybody, and I mean that I hope as well that I will be able to promote discussion on this topic. Mm-hmm. So, starting from the very first slide, I mean, as Christoph has commented, the presentation when I thought about what I could be discussing or presenting here, I thought that there would be probably the possibility of doing 10 rules. Based on my experience. So if we go into slide number two, the first one with the actual content, I would really like to start off as I usually do with a set of disclaimers. And I think that this is important in order to place the context of what I'm going to be presenting here and also to drive the discussion later probably. So the first thing is that I belong to a group, to a research group where ontology engineering is a key part of everything that every single member does. I mean, we normally say that everybody in our group at least should have built an ontology at some point in time in their life, yeah, in order to be able to participate in the group. But however, I mean, we have very different views, very diverging views on what ontology engineering is, in fact. So, I mean, the contents of this is just my own view, and probably I hope that I won't be just taken out from the group after the presentation. So, they are based on my experience. All these things are probably, I mean, not generalizable to every single domain, and especially I think that one important point that we want to make is that these rules that I'm going to be talking, or these deadlocks that I'm going to be talking, are probably mostly based on cases when we have been working with domain experts in domains that are not so ontology savvy. Let's say domains where ontologies have not been used so often, not too many people have been, working already on ontology engineering in those areas. And I think that this is quite important in order to understand the very basic rules and deadlocks that I'm going to be talking about. The last element, of course, is that, when you think about the title, you think that you are going to be able to generate 10 rules. But yesterday night, I was just with the ninth, and I couldn't think of a 10th. So probably, as a result of the discussion, we may be able to get another one just to make them 10. Probably, we could go even farther, even into 20, yeah? I mean, because probably you all have experience in this area. So let's go now into slide three. So I will be setting up the context of some of the examples that I'm going to be talking about. Two very basic examples, one of an old project, a project that has already finished, a Spanish project that typical with private technical companies, universities, content providers from the media industry, and where we wanted to generate ontologies in very multiple, very generic domains, like the news domain or sports, things like that. So, this brought several challenges over here. I was quite involved in this project, and also other members of my team, like Maria Poveda, who was presenting last week also in this for the summit. She was also involved in that. And the second piece of context is something I'm working on right now. In fact, I mean, we have a very important deadline for June 2014, June this year. And it is a group, an ISO group, ISO-like. I mean, INOR is like the ISO organization inside Spain, which generates technical norms. And I am involved, I'm co-leading a group on open data for smart cities. Basically, the goals over there are the provision of common vocabularies for data sets from open data portals. So we want to improve interoperability across public administrations, also open data reusers, and so on. Again, I mean, a context, an area, a domain where ontology development, ontology engineering has not been so common, although, I mean, obviously any type of modeling, I mean, general database modeling has been quite common, and where there are lots of issues to overcome whenever somebody is working on ontology development in that context. Okay, so we now move into slide 4, and I have divided my deadlocks and rules into three main areas. So the first group of deadlocks are those that are related to the moment when you start the ontology engineering process. So we're starting bootstrapping the group, yeah, or bootstrapping the ontology engineering process. This is something that I have been doing, for instance, in this open data ontology context. This is something that I have been doing during the months of January and a little bit of February. So I have them quite recent in my mind, yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to introduce them. So let's go into the following slide. That's the only one that doesn't have a number because I just have to include the screenshot somewhere, but it's slide 5. And one of the very first discussions, and it's quite strange for me when you go into a very non-ontology savvy community is, okay, which tool do we use? And we have seen in the documentation there are lots of tools that can be used. We can use Proxyjet, Topbreed Composer, Neon Toolkit. And we know that all those tools exist, and we should start working on them probably, but I mean, nobody has an idea in this context of how to use those tools. We also know that there are some collaborative tools. We have read some papers, or somebody has been telling us, or we have seen some video lecture on using them. One example, a clear example, is WebProtegy, we need to start using a tool. This is a very common topic, especially when you start the discussion with people who have been used to modeling databases in general. I have to say, I mean, that this is the context that I'm dealing with. So I thought that it was important to comment on those ones. And basically, I mean, my first recommendation over there would be, okay, I mean, we shouldn't be really worried about tools. And I mean, on the role that I normally have as the ontology engineer that acts as a mediator or an enabler for the ontology engineering process, I usually recommend using Excel, which probably, I mean, may look like a very, very strange thing for many of us who are over here, many of you who are in the audience. It's really important to use very simple tools that everybody are able to handle. And although I love using Protégé, I love using WebProtegy, I find them extremely interesting. Whenever you are in a non-ontology savvy community, I think that the killer app to be using during almost all the whole development process is something as simple as Excel, or of course something as simple, I mean, as a Google Doc in order to make it truly collaborative. So just as an example, I'm not sure whether you can see it with a good quality over there. Sorry, because I mean most of the comments are, or most of the questions over there, competency questions, and so on, are in Spanish, yeah, because that's the community that I was addressing. But I just wanted to just show you in slide 6 just an example of how we use Excel or Google Docs, depending on what we are using at each point in time, just to drive the discussion. I believe on the usefulness of competency questions for many ontology engineering activities. This is not the case in with everybody in my group. And in fact, I mean, we have long discussions about that, especially when it comes from, for instance, data models that already exist. But I think that, I mean, from the point of view of starting the documentation process of the ontologies that we are trying to build, I think that they are quite useful. Although, I mean, we shouldn't be trapped by just using competency questions for everything. But an important point that I have over there, I mean, I have highlighted over there, is the status, which means that, I mean, we use Excel just to track also the proposal of new questions, new comments, new competency questions, or new answers, and whether we are accepting them, whether we are still discussing them, whether we are rejecting them. In every single project that we start, sometimes, I mean, those status like markers change. This was a very basic one used for the multimedia ontologies that we have to build in this Buscamedia project. But I mean, they normally change, and we normally change them because we know that we can actually do it, and people find quite comfortable with them. Okay, that would be that long one, deadlock one, deciding the tool. And I mean, my way to solve it is just starting with Excel, because everybody knows it. We're moving to slide 7. I wanted to comment also on the second deadlock that I normally see in these type of groups. Remember that we are starting the employee engineering process. Many of these people, and this is very common, especially with these open data portals, many of these people from public administrations, mainly, they have been told that they have to reuse other ontologies. I mean, they have seen presentations from people, I mean, even from myself, just saying the usefulness of reusing ontologies, and I mean, just saying that that's the basis for ontological engineering for all of us, yeah? But I mean, I feel in fact, at the very beginning, at the very first steps of ontology engineering, this can be a really difficult deadlock or a trap for the creativity of people. I really think, I mean, my recommendation is we should always start in this kind of context working with the experts so that they can provide their definitions on their own terms. I mean, I remember of very basic techniques like card sorting or things like that we could be using in this context. I use Excel for this because I think that's useful, as I have said before. And instead of having all these endless discussions about the terms, looking for the definitions, checking other ontologies that are already available on the web, I just tell them, okay, start just putting your own terms. Start putting your own definitions. Give me pointers to the actual documents, norms, and things like that you are working with every day and where you have your definitions. We will later consider the reuse of other ontologies, but please don't really get obsessed on reusing other ontologies, because we will do it later during the ontology development process. So remember that this is at the very beginning, okay? So slide 8 is the third deadlock, and this is the one, I mean, as I was commenting, probably I will be taken out from the group. I will be just kindly said that I have to leave the group, and I mean, probably you can offer me a job after that, yeah? So the third deadlock is really, okay, I mean, there are methodologies, and the methodology tells me to do these. I mean, I have just put a screenshot of the NEON methodology, and there are all these numbers. I'm not going to go into details of any of those, but they just recommend paths, different paths that you can actually use in order to develop your ontologies, depending on whether you are actually using ontological or non-ontological resources, your use of ontology design patterns, and so on. This methodology is very complete, and I mean, and there are many others from the past. We all know them, I mean, and we are all quite aware of what can be done from them. But I mean, whenever you present these to ontology developers, to experts that are just starting the ontology engineering process and they have never done it before, this is really scary. My recommendation, and we go to slide 9, is that basically there are lightweight and heavyweight methodologies, and you have to adapt to the cases of different types of groups that you have to be working with. This doesn't mean that NEON methodology is a heavyweight methodology. I mean, I wouldn't claim that, because they would probably kill me. I would actually say that, you really have to identify very clearly which are the scenarios that you want to work with, without even giving any details about which scenarios you are using. Just giving a very simple set of activities that people have to use, have to follow. And especially, I have found very, very useful, especially in the context of open data portals, to use a very agile approach. We select a set of competency questions, or whatever we want to call them, for each sprint, and we just discuss them over 1 week. And after 1 week, we come together and we discuss about the outcomes that we have obtained. All of it done through the Excel files that we were discussing before. Okay. So this is my approach, and this is my approach especially in this context. I understand that there are other contexts where you can probably not do it so easily or in such an agile manner. But for those type of ontologies, I think that's a very useful activity to do. So we move now into slide 10, which is the moment when we start implementing the ontologies. Okay? So we have already started the process. We have bootstrapped the process. People are now comfortable with using Excel. They have been discussing over the definitions, over terms, and so on. And now it is the time to start doing the next step. Yeah. Okay. So slide 11. The fourth deadlock that I could identify is that we should avoid large groups. This is just like a naive comment. Most of you will be probably already laughing and saying, "Okay, yeah, I knew that." Yeah. But especially, in my case with public administration, groups tend to be very large. And this is a very common process, in this type of context. And, in that context, I would say that in the context of the sprint mode that I was commenting before, I prefer having very small groups of experts with a few ontology engineers. Ideally, for me, it would be 4 experts, 1 ontology engineer. Normally it is me or anybody else from my team or from people that I collaborate with. And we are basically acting as enablers, just making the right questions to understand whether taxonomy or classification should be disjoint or should be exhaustive. We know all the patterns that we have to follow, but we don't tell the patterns to people because they only have to provide the knowledge over there. So that's my recommendation, and also avoid the non-experts. That's, a naive, straightforward recommendation. But non-experts, especially in this public administration context, are very dangerous. Yeah. So that's quite important because they are thinking on different goals for their ontologies. They are sometimes even thinking, especially the top people, just on making the photo of themselves appearing in the open data portal rather than anything else. Yeah. Okay. Slide 12. The fifth deadlock. This is a very complex one. I don't have a very clear recommendation. I don't even believe my own recommendation here. I'm working with the Spanish community a lot. Yeah. And in the Spanish community, we speak Spanish. And obviously the terms that we have to use are in general in Spanish because they are given by the law, by the general terms that we are using. And also because developers who are going to reuse our data that is based on our ontologies are going to reuse ontologies in Spanish. Or they want to use terms in Spanish. So, in general, my recommendation is that even if we all know that identifiers are not important, and we could use RDFS label, RDFS common with different languages in order to, just provide the context of what we are presenting, people feel much more comfortable when the identifiers are in their own language. So what I normally do is that I recommend generating all terms in your own language, in my case in Spanish, and then just making the links to the identifiers that already exist. Yeah. Okay, if I have 4 person, then I will just be generating my own person class, and then I will be connecting it later. How those employees look like, they are strange. They are not the ones that we are used to, but normally when we are working with our scientific papers, we are very focused on providing ontologies that are in English, we all understand them, but we should be careful with this very specific aspect, which is very social. And there are lots of people, that's the case in Spain, but I assume that in many other languages it happens, that they are very against having mixed languages in their terminologies, in their ontologies, in their vocabularies. I move to slide 13, which is the sixth deadlock, which is another one that comes probably from our own fault. Yeah? I mean, I teach OWL, I teach description logics at university. As I say over here, that's a very funny thing to teach, because I'm very showing the niceties of reasoning, what you can do with consistency checking, and so on and so forth. It is very useful in many domains. It is fundamental in many domains. But in the ones that I have been working with more recently, it is not so important. It generates really like a very uncomfortable situation for people who want only to find situations where they can do some inference and demonstrate that they are doing something nice. Yeah. Again, I mean, this really depends on the domain, but I'm just telling you of those domains that I have been working with. So in this context, again, I mean, I'm not even going into Copilot yet, or into Neo Toolkit yet. I'm just working with text patterns. What I do is that I really focus on guiding the experts on providing really good term definitions that can allow me later to generate the corresponding formalization. So, I mean, I have put over there a couple of examples that I have been recently working last week on, and I mean, it's just like giving them these kind of patterns and working with the domain experts those patterns. I think that it's the most interesting activity that we can do in order to avoid that deadlock that really comes into them because they really want to show something, yeah? Something running, something that shows some type of inferencing or intelligent capacity, as they normally call it, yeah? So let's move now into slide 14, which is the opposite. I find it very, very funny because in open data portals, in this kind of development, I have the two extremes, and I have to be in the middle, yeah? So I have also other people that have been told that, just having complex ontologies is a nonsense, that, I mean, if you are doing linked data publishing, the only thing that you should be using is very lightweight taxonomies. Don't even put the domain or ranch into any property because that's dangerous, and that doesn't promote reusability. And even use RDF schema only, yeah? Again, I mean, my recommendation is the same. Use text patterns. I mean, this is really like going into the details of what people from the documentation world would do, and I think that works quite well in these type of domains, okay? So I move now into slide 15. There is a process, a magic process somewhere. I have now my OWL or RDFS files. I have been working on them. Normally, it's an ontology engineer that I reserve to do that formalization process, but it is normally quite easy whenever you have all those textual pieces of documentation available. And if we move to slide 16, I would say that the eighth deadlock is that, people are very concerned about doing a very good ontology. Yeah? Again, I mean, probably it's our fault. Whenever we are just talking about ontology engineering, we are always talking about having a good ontology, a very clear view of the world, of the piece of the domain that we are dealing with. And, I mean, we have been said as well that the ontology has to be consistent, and this comes normally from our description logic lectures. And then, I mean, what I want to see is whether if I load it in Protégé, I run the reasoner, there is nothing wrong. There are some inferences probably, I don't care. But no more work is needed. So, I mean, one of my recommendations, and I don't know whether even Maria is around among the members over here of the audience, and she would be happy to see it, but I mean, I think that's for me that's not enough. It is quite important to go for non-logical checks as well. And I mean, in this case, we have found out that using the OPS pixel scanner is a really really good way of having people work towards the goal of trying to have the less pitfalls, little pitfalls as possible, yeah? And I think that this is in general quite useful for them, yeah? Okay? Anyway, I mean, I tell them not to get obsessed, you know? We're moving to slide 17, and I have the last deadlock. As I told you, I mean, I only have 9, I don't have 10. So how do I tell the others how to use the ontology? This is something that we normally forget. This is not so much of a deadlock, but it is a deadlock for those ones trying to use our ontology. And we all know that we have to provide the documentation But how many cases have you seen in general of ontologies outside that are this type out there and where the competency questions are available for people to review? There are not so many. So in this case, I mean, I really put a focus of spending, in these cases of 6 months ontology development, is spending at least 1 month on describing very clearly the examples, providing HTML documentation of the ontology and also in Word as well. And you have a couple of examples over there in the URL that I'm providing you over there on some of the ontologies that we are making available. Yes, I mean, like the very simple descriptions, at least we always recommend at least giving some example to provide some documentation for potential reusers. Yeah. So this is all. We're moving to slide 18. I mean, I have just copied the first slide just to remind you that, I mean, this is my own view. This is for domains where I think, I mean, ontologies have not been used so much. And if I mean, as I have told you, there are no 10 rules, there are no 10 deadlocks. Probably you can comment on them. I mean, I have seen that there has been a lot of activity on the chat, so I will go now into that and check that for the discussion moment, yeah, when we are actually discussing. Okay, so I have been also trying to be a little bit provocative. I know that, I mean, many of you probably are not feeling very comfortable with some of the things that I have said. I hope that this can promote as well discussion. Okay, so thank you, and I mean, happy to start discussing with you.
Thank you very much, Oscar, for this very insightful talk. As you said, yes, there has been quite some reaction on the chat, so please look into that. And please also keep in mind that at the very end, after the three presentations, we will have a joint discussion. So I hope the three speakers will stay with us and help us to summarize and synthesize what we learned here today. Okay, let's move on to the second speaker, Dr. Naval Thakkar, who will be talking today about modeling cultural variations in interpersonal communication for augmenting user-generated content. So Naval is a research fellow at the Artificial Intelligence Group at the University of Leeds. He holds a PhD in Semantic Web Service Integration from Nottingham Trent University. And his current research interests include semantic data exploration and semantic data analysis. Welcome, Dava. We are very much looking forward to your talk. Thank you very much. The stage is all yours.
Okay. Thank you, Christoph. Thanks for the introduction. Thank you, Oscar, also for excellent presentation and excellent observations you've shared with us. I've observed many of these things you highlighted, and I'm sure others have as well. So the title of presentation I have is Modeling Cultural Variations in Interpersonal Communication for Augmenting User-Generated Content. It's a slightly in contrast with the first talk. This is more about how we have gone about building an ontology step by step for a complex domain, and I haven't highlighted that many lessons we have learned, but I'm sure, you know, it will come out in the discussion, or you might be able to pick up something. At the least, I'll be able to get some feedback from you about how we have done things. So this work was done in the context of a FP7 EU project called IMREAL. I move to slide number 2. So, which gives the outline of brief outline of my presentation. So I will start with talking about the context of this work. As I said, is the IMREAL project. I will highlight the domain we were interested in, which is cultural variations and interpersonal communication, and then I'll talk about the ontology we have developed, which we are calling M1 Plus, and how we have evaluated it. And at the end, I'll provide some conclusions. So slide number 3, please. So the IMREAL project, the main problem area the IMREAL project targeted was linking simulated environments and real-world experience. What we mean by this is, just to provide some more information, we're talking about simulated environments, which is on the left-hand side. Some examples are given there. These simulated environments in this project were on cultural and interpersonal communication. And with the globalized world we live in, you can imagine that these are becoming ever popular. And we also have looked at the research where businesses are citing, you know, lack of cultural awareness as a key factor or one of the biggest factor for losing business opportunities. So you can imagine there is lots of interest into this. In terms of science, in terms of innovation, we argued in this project that there is a gap. There is a gap between the situation which are demonstrated in these sort of simulators, the state of the art simulators, and what happens in the real world. And we believed that one of the reasons why this is the case is because the simulator developers who develop this sort of simulators have very limited have access to very handful number of experiences while they design the storyboards. So that has contributed somehow to this gap. So if we move on to slide number four. And in terms of one of the key things we looked in this project was, can we use social media to address this problem? Because in social media, people are tweeting, people are posting about their experiences in variety of situations, including interpersonal communication encounters. And can we use this somehow to address this problem we are having? If what we are calling this sort of experiences is digital traces. Can we use, if these digital traces can be somehow aggregated and analyzed to address this problem? So that's what we were looking at. So if we move to slide number five. And we all are in semantic web, from semantic web community, and one of the, I think probably you already know this, that one of the, good tool, or a technique, a very competent technique for doing such type of aggregation and analysis of digital traces is semantic augmentation. The definition of, semantic augmentation is that it's a process of attaching semantics to a selected part of text. So basically, rather than using strings, using concepts to tag. But one thing which is also well known about semantic augmentation is that it requires semantic model or an ontology of a particular domain. And when we're looking at, doing this for the culture and interpersonal communication, we couldn't find any ontologies. And that's what we had the expertise in the team, not only the computer scientists, but also social scientists. So that's where we have invested our efforts in, and that's what I'm going to talk about in the rest of the slides. So if you move to slide number six, please. So, before I talk about this ontology, I thought it's better to clarify what we mean by culture, because there are tons of definitions about culture, and we took a broad notion of culture and also narrowed it down. So the broad notion of culture we'll lean on is the definition from Kasima, which defines culture in terms of a set of beliefs, values, behaviors, and practices that characterize a given group of people. So the focus here is group of people. And again, in terms of culture, obviously the group of people could be, a nationality, or it could be based on gender, or it could be based on ethnicity, it could be based on regions, and so on. So again, we had a narrow scope, which was just focusing on nationality culture, and that's what this is the scope we started with. If you move to slide number seven, please. So the ontology we have developed is called Activity Model Ontology. The short form is M1+. Basically, it represents the main aspects of an interpersonal communication activity. So what are the aspects within interpersonal communication activity? But it also says what are, out of all these aspects, which aspects have cultural variations. So we start with interpersonal communication and then say which are the things, which are the concepts which have cultural variations. So in the remaining presentation, I'll discuss how it has been designed and how it's been evaluated. We'll move to slide 8, please. So for the development of the ontology, we're following a mixture of roughly these two methodologies, which is Uskoll and King, and methontology. And obviously it has few steps. The first one is planning, where we had a team of, as I mentioned before, social scientists and computer scientists taking part into this. Also in terms of interculturality, we had a very culturally diverse team of seven with various cultural backgrounds and exposures. And in terms of scope and purpose, as I already mentioned, that we narrowed it down to we were focusing on only culture in the context of interpersonal communication, and also we were focusing on nationality-based culture. In terms of ontology capture, the process started with basically, you know, we work with social scientists. They are not familiar with this approach and these sort of tool sets we provided to them. But they basically followed a squeezed approach. By squeezed approach, we mean that they collected competency questions from other cultural experts and using it as empirical data. At the same time, they had tons of, you know, literature available to them, which they surveyed on the subject, and that's what they're using as a theoretical data. They also, the terms they were gathering, they were also, you know, storing into a glossary of term or knowledge glossary. In terms of technical side, we were quite aware and quite conscious that we wanted to do modularization and modularization from the outset. So the ontology we were developing, which we are calling it core ontology, we were creating number of modules from the beginning, and these are the three modules, which is activity module, interpersonal communication, and cultural module. And I've got a few snapshot of the terms we captured in these modules in next few slides. So if we move to the next slide, please, slide number 10. So this is a we'll go to 9, sorry, slide number 9. So this is the specification of M1 Plus, and it has most of the things I already said about scope, about purpose, which is, you know, doing semantic augmentation. But I would like to highlight, you know, briefly the source of knowledge row, which is the last row, which highlights the number of, you know, cultural theories the social scientists had looked into to derive, you know, the relevant concept for the domain we were interested in. So if you move to slide number 10 now. So this is called activity module, which was based on, among those theories, it was based on activity theory. So we picked a theory to be over upper layer or base layer. So if you don't know about activity theory, activity theory is quite old. It offers sort of a conceptualization in the form of activity structure for understanding a complex activity. So it provides basically, you know, the base concept you can find for any human activity. And this base concept goes like something like, you know, every activity has a participant, they call it subject. Every activity has a tool which these participants use. Every activity is governed by some sort of rules and norms. And every activity has some sort of emotions embedded in. So literally any activity you can think of, you can apply this sort of, you know, concepts and its instantiation to it. So we use this as a base layer, and we converted this activity system concepts into an ontology, and that was our base layer of this core ontology. We'll move to 11. And because our focus was interpersonal communication, so we were looking into these base concepts from the activity module and expanding it depending upon where there is an interpersonal communication, the concepts. So we expanded the concept of tool into mental tools and physical tools. So these are the tools people use in interpersonal communication encounters. So physical tools could be in a job interview, you might use your CV, or in mental tools, for example, you use your interpersonal skills for job interview. And then we expanded further into verbal and nonverbal communication, but we were only interested into nonverbal communication, so we had further specification of nonverbal communication, such as paralanguage. One of them is body language, which is further specified in slide number 12. So we'll move to slide number 12. So this gives a further specification of body language. I will not go into the detail because of the time, but I've left this slide if somebody is interested into it. So we'll move to slide number 13 now. This is about the cultural module. So we had a upper layer for culture as well, where the main concepts, the first diagram on the top shows the main concepts about culture, including cultural group as it was in the definition of culture, but also in cultural individual, and then it is composed of cultural element. And each of these concepts were further specified. So, for example, the image beneath shows the how we further specified cultural elements. And there you can see how a concept of nonverbal communication from interpersonal communication is linked to culture as having cultural aspects. So we'll move to slide number 14, please. So this is the last bit, which it says ontology coding is new. Other three are from previously. So we finally, encoded this ontologies, this terms which were captured into an ontology in OWL. We're calling it core ontology, and I provided a link there as an output where you can find them. So this is converted into an OWL ontology. So that was nice and shaping up very well. We'll move to slide 15. But there was a problem which was sort of obvious and very apparent. One of the limitation of the ontology we had developed so far was that it's obviously not fit for purpose. The reason being that we wanted to basically use this ontology to tag social content, but it's also you can imagine, but there is a comment in the middle of this slide from a YouTube video talking about handshake and Brazilian greeting, and generally in social content you will find concrete terms being mentioned. While what this ontology provided us was very abstract terms and abstract concepts, such as greeting instead of type of greeting, which is kiss on cheek or handshake. So that was an obvious limitation. But we converted this. This was an opportunity because the core ontology basically provided upper level of terms which we can enrich. So we can go and look out other data sets. Where we can use this as a frame of reference, what we wanted to search for concrete instantiation. And that's where we looked upon on linked data and specifically DBpedia. My rest of the presentation is based on that. So we'll move to slide 16 now. So in terms of DBpedia, I guess most of you might be already aware of it, but I would like to highlight one particular aspect of DBpedia which we have exploited in our work, the richness which DBpedia provides in terms of its category chains. So, for example, DBpedia has resource pages on various things. One example is body language, as you can see in this image. and which has, you know, if you look at DBpedia or Wikipedia and the links at the bottom of the page, which has, you know, various categories. So, for example, body language will have human positions and nonverbal communication. And if you look at the, you know, the other resources from human positions and nonverbal communication, for example, bowing is one of them, apart from body language, then you can find such sort of resources bowing. And then when you look at the, you know, other categories of the resources you have found, such as bowing, then you'll find, you know, other categories apart from human positions and nonverbal communication, such as gestures. And again, you can follow that and you will find chick kissing and you can continue this journey. So that is quite rich and quite, you know, suitable for the task we were after. We wanted the concrete instantiation and we can stop at different levels. That's what this arrows with different levels, levels identify. You can just map it to your direct match in DBpedia for your ontology. So we can stop at body language, but we can also follow the category chains and we can go further and extract and bit more. We'll move to slide 17. In terms of, exploiting DBpedia this way, and mainly category chains, we had to do two things. First, we had to link M1 Plus with DBpedia, and we had a sort of mapping mechanism, which is described here. Basically, we used, surface from the ontology, and also we used WordNet to enrich it further, and then used two services DBpedia provides, which is Lookup and DBpedia Category Lookup Index. So that we can match, the terms from one ontology to our ontology to DBpedia. And that's what we did. So we'll move to 18. I will not go into detail of this slide, but we there were some misses. So only 62% of terms we could match, and there were particular reasons for that, and this slide basically provides those reasons. We'll move to slide number 19. Which highlights the second step. So once we mapped the terms from M1 Plus to DBpedia, we had to do the extraction to get that category change. So in that image, if you remember, from body language to going to bowing and further. So we had a pipeline to do that. And we could extract, which is in this image, and we could extract, we extracted up to level 3. So level 1 was in size just 1 megabyte, and level 3, which was 1.27 gigabyte, quite huge chunk we extracted, 1,000-fold from level 1. So we'll move to slide number 20. And basically this is a reference slide which provides the link to the whole ontology suite, which is Core plus DBpedia Enriched, provided at the same link, which is on this slide. So slide 21, because I want to talk a little bit about the evaluation we did. In terms of evaluation, the goal was to check whether it is fit for purpose, for the semantic augmentation of content, from this particular domain. And the two things I would like to quickly highlight there, the literature basically advised us that we should look at domain coverage, not logical correctness when we are looking for fit for purpose. And in terms of, to do so, we needed a gold standard textual corpus, which had terms already annotated, the correct terms already annotated for this domain. But the problem was there was no gold standard available for this domain. We'll move to slide number 22. So basically we set out to create a gold standard, and we collected the variety of content for this, including user-generated content, news articles, Wikipedia pages, and some specialized web resources, so some websites on the domain. We'll move to 23. And we wanted to give it to us, to an expert for annotation. So we had to sample it because it was quite big size. And what we did was we used a GLOBE clusters, societal clusters, which was a work done by GLOBE Project, where they had provided clusters of 62 countries based on the similarity between the cultures. So we made sure that in the sample there was at least one document from each of the clusters. And we used the service of an expert. We had who had a quite high cultural intelligence score, 6.5 out of 7, who did this annotation. We'll move to slide 25 and we'll not stay very long there. Basically, this expert used the GATE to do the annotations, and imagine the terms that this person thought were relevant to the domain. We'll move to 25 now. And this, basically, we wanted to make sure that it's not biased, so we involved another expert who also annotated a random sample from the first expert, and basically we measured IAA, which was 92.7%, which was quite significant. We'll move to 26, which basically talks about we ran GATE now with M1 Plus. And compared it against what this expert did on the same sample, and basically we reported the results in terms of classic information retrieval techniques, how well the GATE system did with M1 Plus in terms of precision recall and app measure. So we'll move to 27, which has the result of this comparison. So in terms of precision, if you look at the top figure and the right hand side box. You can see that, you know, the core ontology, which had no enrichment, was quite accurate, more than 80%. And level 3 was doing not that great, just above 60%. But if you look at the recall, the picture was reversed. So if you look at the bottom figure with the recall and the box there, as you can see that core was doing quite bad, but level 3 was close to 80%. And that gave app measure, which is the right inside figure, where, you know, the level 3 did the best among all this, gave the best performance, close to 75%. So level 3 performed the best and was matching 75% to what the cultural expert had. So we'll move to 28, and I'm going to skip 28 and 29. I knew that I'll be short of time, but I've just left it for somebody who wants to find out more about what were the false positives and what were false negatives. So we'll skip 28, 29, and we'll move to 30, which is thankfully the conclusion, which starts with two obvious statements at the beginning, which is first is culture is a very key topic. It's becoming ever popular, and not only simulators, but beyond as well. I was just talking to my colleague about urban environments, and people are using, considering culture there as well. Culture is a complex topic. You know, you need to scope it, and you need to focus, and we try to do that in this work. And we have developed an ontology of this domain, and the lesson learned there is that, you know, social theories are quite, especially a domain like this, which is ill-defined, are quite useful. But also, you know, we were curious to find out, you know, whether DBpedia will have something about culture, and we were very doubtful. But it turns out that, you know, DBpedia does actually know about cultural aspects after all. It just needs a bit of structure to go and find what you're looking for. So that's it. I'll leave you with this quote from Mary Parker Follett about culture and diversity. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for this very interesting talk and this fantastic quote at the end. So I hope you saw that there have been a number of interesting questions and comments in the chat for you to address. For now, let's move on to our third and last presentation, which will be given by Johannes Trame in replacement of Peter Hase, and the title is Developing Semantic Applications with the Information Workbench Aspects of Ontology Engineering. So I don't have the most up-to-date CV from Johannes Trame, but if I remember correctly, he's a graduate from the Department of Geoinformatics from the University of Münster, and now he's an ontology engineer at Fluid Operations, and he's especially involved in their work on ontology-based data access, in particularly in the context of the European Union's Framework 7 call on a scalable end-user access to big data. Johannes, looking forward to your presentation.
Thanks, Christoph. Hi all. I will start with, of course, the first slide. As Christoph already told us, I'm here as a replacement for Peter. Unfortunately, he got ill this morning, so I hope I do my best in presenting you a pragmatic view on industry needs and how we treat the topic of ontology engineering within our company. So I will move on to the second slide. The presentation is structured as follows. So I, by taking some examples or presenting some examples, I will basically present all the different facets that we use ontologies, starting from data integration, visualization, editing, and querying. So you get a basic understanding on how we actually use ontologies and what purpose we use it as them. And then in the end, towards the end, I will review actually what are our problems in reusing ontologies and what's our perspective on this topic. So our main product is our information workbench. As Christoph said, it's a semantic platform for data integration. It starts, of course, integrating. We have a concept of providers for adapting different data sources and formats and bring them together in a unified way in our semantic platforms. For that, we use we base it on established mapping frameworks such as R2ML and Silk. So our whole stack is put on standards, open standards, and technologies. On the second level, we access the data having a flexible self-service UI, which is based on the MediaWiki, and for that we have different kind of widgets for visualization, exploration, and dashboarding. And at least we also have support for semantic search, meaning faceted search, also and also other kinds of semantic search. Actually, the really nice thing about the platform is that we can invoke and trigger action and services from this in the semantic world. So meaning basically, for example, to trigger, we'll come back to this example later, triggering the cloning of a virtual machine in a data center domain, for example. So I will move on to the third slide. Here we have a simple overview of our platform. In the bottom, you see basically the resource stack, which means we're covering the whole IT stack from different data sources. As I said, this can be on the right side, open data sources. So we have providers for CCAN as well as other structured data formats already available. Also for enterprise data sources, meaning basically data warehouse solutions. And on the left side, then we have also adapters for plugging into the infrastructure layer and operating really on the lowest level of the IT and IT stack. On top of that, our information workbench is basically providing a unified view. On top of the platform layer, we have our solution development kit or software development kit. As the name says, it's supposed to provide a SDK for developing different domain-specific solutions on top of the platform. And as you see in the center of the SDK, we have the ontology. So that's really the central backbone of the whole stack. I'll give you some examples later. As I said before, starting from integration to visualization, editing, and querying. So on the top of this SDK or with the help of the SDK, we have developed different solutions in different domains. Our most prominent example is the eCloud Manager, which basically provides a unified view about the data center domain. Besides that, we have developed different solutions for different also research projects, but also other industry projects. One is, for example, the Optique project, where we basically want to enable really end users to access big data by use of ontologies. Another example is the protein engineering portal. The project is called NewProt. There we use semantic technologies for integrating metadata about proteins, and then different services can be triggered and executed and bringing back the computed results about protein engineering. I will move on to the fourth slide. Coming back to our most prominent example and solution, the eCloud Manager, as I said, the eCloud Manager provides a unified view about the whole hardware infrastructure, so to say, starting from storages, hypervisors, applications, networks, and different business resources. There we have an in-memory DB, basically having a virtualized semantic view on these things, but as well as also data warehouse-driven provider concepts. Furthermore, we have also a rule engine running, so triggering different events, for example, notifying events about that the storage is running out of capacity or things like that. And on top of that, we have then also for the end user a self-service portal, which is then built with the help of our wiki, and where the end user has really access to services, but as well to dashboards, visualizing the data, and so on. So I will move on to the fifth slide. This is our enterprise cloud ontology, which is also the structural background or bare bone of the eCloud Manager solution. Here you see all the concepts involved. Of course, this is only the core. Besides that, we have different extensions developed also by partners. So here, really, the challenge is also to have, first of all, of course, a unified view on the different vendors stakeholders involved here, but as well as having extensions to cover, being extensible to cover also new use cases and problem domains. I will move on to the sixth slide to give you a simple example about our data-driven UI. So as I said, our UI is based on the Semantic Media Wiki. And within there, we have a concept of widgets where the administrator can basically build new interfaces, which are driven then by really the ontologies, building template according to the classes of the ontologies, and then embedding different kind of widgets into the wiki site, which are then automatically populated by the instances. So I will move on to the seventh slide. Here you see again, the ontology is really the structural backbone of our system, especially for the UI. So, as you see on the right side, we have this template mechanism where the user can define for different classes of ontologies different templates, and these templates then automatically populated by the platform using the instance data from the REF graph. In the end, then we get rendered wiki pages, which then can also be customized and also customized for more end user purpose or wiki style being still wiki style. I will move on to slide number 8. Here you see some different kinds of widgets. So we have widgets for analytics and reporting. This is especially important in the domain of data center management, for example. But then we have as well widgets for exploration and visualization of locations, temporal aspects, but as well also, for example, in the semantic publishing domain, we have then also social aspects and widgets for authoring and content creation. So I will move on to slide number 8. Here you see a simple example. You could imagine really being in the music domain. We have here, this could be a widget for or the template for an artist page, and there we just have a simple Sparkle query selecting all the released records by the special by the instance of the artist concept. In the end, the rendered result for the Beatles would be, for example, the chart in the bottom. So moving on to slide number 10, here you see a different example, a little bit more wrapped up. Again, the Beatles, then showing also the locations where the Beatles are located, and the members of the Beatles, and so on. So moving on to slide number 11, coming to a different aspect, namely editing. So we use the ontology in our systems also for supporting the user to edit the data and to fill in new data. So our triple editor, for example, is using mainly domains and ranges to populate or to provide suggestions to the end user, so that he is then can easily populate and add new data to the instances pages. Going on to slide number 11. Here you see a simple example of our ontology repository. So far it's quite simple. So it shows you a list of all available ontologies in the systems. As you see, we have in there by default the event ontology, the time ontology, as well as some ontologies from the BBC, for example. If you go on to slide number 13, you see we have also some simple support for the end user to edit this ontologies. Of course, it's nothing compared to tools like Protégé, but at least the end user can see or get at a glance what kind of classes available, can edit commands and labels, and define also ranges and equivalence classes. So it's a basic purpose ontology editor, so to say. Going on to slide number 14, as Christoph said, so I'm involved in the Optique project, and there another aspect of using ontologies on our platform is really to enable conceptually the end user to use the ontology as a conceptual backend. To enable the end user to send queries against the data sources. So in the case of Statoil, for example, IT experts spend 80% of their time in assembling different SQL queries and so on to really solving the engineer's end user needs. And there are several iterations of that. And of course, there are also a lot of misunderstandings between the end engineer and the IT expert. So the Optique solution then basically does the query translation and kind of replacing the IT expert. The IT expert is still in place there, namely managing the mappings and so on. But here the whole idea is really the end user solution. So the engineer is taking the ontology and then querying the data. So going on to slide number 15, you see a simple example of this. What is the first prototype of the OPEAK project. So here the end user is able to use a visual query formulation tool, which is automatically populated by the ontology and only also displays those concepts which are in the conceptual scope of the end user. And then the end user is basically able to visually assemble his information needs and sending the query to the platform. Going on to slide number 16. After having introduced you to how and where we basically use ontologies and what's the role in our platform for ontologies, I will now go on to report on how we actually engineer these ontologies and also what are the problems we have with convincing customers as well as also software engineers here to reuse ontologies. So first of all, we have some expertise here in-house, several PhDs in semantic technologies, different of aspects of semantic technologies, and of course try to bring these all together, but still we also a mixed team, so to say, with a lot of software engineers. And it's always hard to train really newbies or regular software engineers how to reuse ontologies and how to develop them. Especially for the end users or for customers, it's then still difficult to extend ontologies on their own. And using also the ontologies to extend basically the platform functionality. For reusing ontologies, we try to reuse where possible. So we highly acknowledge ontologies as a valuable asset. They basically come for free, but so the purpose is here, of course, to keep interoperability to existing data. But as well as having also some really conceptual building blocks for reusable solutions building on top of our platform. The third is basically to also enable partners and customers to extend ontologies for different use cases. There we also interact with them to develop and extend ontologies. And the third, the fourth case is basically that the ontologies are already in place and the customer then just selects ontology from our repository and starts to build or extend his application according to the ontology.
Johannes, we have about 5 minutes left.
Okay. During this, we take I'm moving on to slide number 17. During this, we take a quite pragmatic approach to ontology engineering. So as our software development is also quite agile, it often is the case that we have the data or the instances first, either imported directly from the semantic world or being converted, and then we put a schema on top. Typically, this is driven by agile needs and the intermediate need of having a solution at hand. And then, when it comes to finalizing the ontology, we basically hand simple class hierarchies and enrich them with properties, with domain and branch properties. So that's basically what we do here. Of course, we formalize them also in OWL and have also sometimes more formalized ontologies. But for most use cases, it's restricted to as I said, simple class hierarchies. As methodologies, we basically keep it rather informal, starting often with a whiteboard, take also some elements from existing ontology engineering methodologies, have also some alignment regarding, of course, syntactic aspects, but as well as also design patterns, starting from logical design patterns like NRE relations, but as well as also conceptual design patterns, for example, for modeling events and so on. Tooling, there's basically everything involved, starting from the simple text editor or editing in our platform, as well as going or using Protégé. So that's how we basically approach the challenge of ontology engineering here in the house. So I'm going on to slide number 18. The main difficulty in reuse is basically to motivate the people here to see an intermediate value in solving also the conceptual integration problem and not just solving the intermediate problem at hand. Often also software engineers have a preference, a clear preference to having their own or building their own solution. So, and it's not always easy to there's a certain barrier to understand existing ontology. So before people go and understand even here existing ontologies, then there's already an intermediate solution at hand. So that's an urgent problem we have here. The question whether ontology reuse is always a benefit, I clearly have to say it's not per se a benefit. It's really hard to assess the quality and the relevance of adoption, especially for non-experts. We often use repositories such as linked open vocabularies. They're really good steps towards providing a more quantitative view and also having some social aspects in there. So from that point of view, we would really acknowledge having some more social rankings and recommendations with these kinds of tools. Now I'm going on to slide number 19. You see the list of some ontologies we use here. Most of them are quite domain specific. For example, the music ontology, or SciDoc, or the conference ontology. But we have also use more generic ones. For example, for tagging, we use SCoS. But as well also in business domains, we use ontologies like Salt and Service for Lifecycle Collaboration ontology, driven by IBM. So these are, as you see, quite domain-specific ontologies. Also, we use in some cases, for example, in the conference case, we use also upper-level ontologies, or at least align with them. For example, triggering events, and or modeling events, there we build up on Deutsche Light, for example. So going to my last slide, and to my conclusion, for us, the ontologies are, first of all, they build really the structural backbone of our application and of our platform. Of course, they play an important role for data integration, getting their data in, and on the conceptual level, then for querying and visualization, but as well as for, triggering action and invoking also different kinds of services. So that's kind of the actionable data concept. The main advantage in reusing ontologies is for us that there can be modular artifacts and enable basically also to build or really force us to build usable solutions on top of the platform. Quite important is that they with semantic technologies and ontologies in the back end, we are able to really easily extend the backbone, and we are not bound to a fixed schema up front. And this in the end also enables us to have or really being quick and flexible in developing application development for different domains up on the platform. So yeah, if you like, try it out by yourself. I hope I was able to give you some insights in how we use ontologies and what's the role for us. Thank you all.
Okay, thank you very much for this interesting insight from the industry. I think that was a really great match to the previous presentations, and I hope this will steer quite some discussions now. I already see that there's something going on in the chat, so maybe we use the last 25 minutes that we have for the open discussions between the audience and the speakers. So if you would like to raise a question or you have a comment, please raise your hand in the chat. You can do this at the very right bottom. There's a small hand signal, and then you can unmute yourself. So while we are waiting for the first reactions, let me start with one question for both Johannes and Oscar. So maybe you noted that on Oscar's slide, it said that typically people recommend not to use domain and range restrictions because they tend to reduce ontology reuse because they have an inferential semantics which many conceptual modelers are not aware of. And then on Johannes' slides, we learned that this is one of those elements in knowledge representation where they get most of in terms of recommending vocabularies or whatever. So maybe Johannes and Oscar, you can comment on that situation and give us your thoughts.
Yeah.
Press star 7 to unmute yourself.
Mm-hmm. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I think that that's, as I was commenting, this is one of those plain comments that come from people who have heard something in terms of, okay, somebody has told them that in any linked data-based ontology, those are the lightweight ontologies that are being used in many cases for producing linked data. High domain and ranges is dangerous. I mean, this is one of those plain sentences that get into the community, into people, and then whenever you are telling them, okay, I mean, just including domain and ranges is quite useful in general because it allows you to further characterize your properties and to understand a little bit better what your properties are about. They always come with this idea that somebody X told me that that I shouldn't use domain or I shouldn't use range, and that's one of those things that I have to fight with. Yeah. So my view in general is that I normally like those cases where domain and ranges are available. I like them because I feel more comfortable on the care that has been taken by ontology developers or those domain experts who have been helped by ontology developers in developing their ontologies. This is like a very personal view. If I see an ontology with good sets of domain and ranges, I mean, not too over detailed, but at least a few concepts here and there in the domain and ranges, I feel much better.
Okay. So I think that this may stem, and I have the same observation that you said, I think this stems from the work of Alamont and Hendler from the working book for the handbook for the working ontologist, where they make some interesting cases why often it's better to use local domain and range restrictions than global domain and range restrictions. But we have a hand raised from Amanda. So Amanda, why don't you press star 7 and give us your opinion?
Thank you. I agree with you first of all about what one of the main sources of this view is, and I have to say I have run into it occasionally. It drives me nuts. But I think it's both bad practice, and I think it's based on a misdiagnosis. And so, and I'll give my little mini rant and then ask for if you all agree or not. One is that here's what I think is the misdiagnosis. Very, very frequently, people represent properties at an inconsistent or inappropriate level of generality. Sometimes it's as simple as the name of the property being very general, something like, you know, possesses or controls, but the domain and range being very specific to the actual domain that you're working in. And that's just, you know, a common sloppiness that can be cleaned up. But people's solution to this, instead of saying, well, let's make sure that the name and the domain and range are consistent, and then, or maybe if we have a lot to do, we know we're going to need the general property and the specific one represent both, right? Instead of doing that, they just say, okay, take off the domain and range. Now, the reason why I think that's bad practice is because I think, in fact, it doesn't enable reuse. It enables misuse. It makes it very hard for somebody else looking at the ontology to see, what was this supposed to do, right? What is this meant to be used for? The domain and range are sometimes the only thing that distinguish, on a quick look, you know, two similar properties. So I think this is a terrible practice, and that it's based on a correct identification of a problem, but a misdiagnosis of where it's coming from, and a wrong solution. So I'll stop now.
Okay, I think that's an excellent example, and we need to make sure we keep this for the record. Especially, I like your half example. I think the situation is a little bit more difficult because, as you said, if you want to use global domains and ranges, you need to really be careful if you want your ontology to be reused that you don't have this half relation that is all including, and then you end up with inferences that you haven't foreseen. Very good. So maybe we go down the list with Matthew next, and then Johannes.
I just wanted to follow up on what Amanda was saying, because the reason that you usually get these problems is that the range and domain are set too restrictively. And obviously setting no range and domain really says that you're setting them up at the level of thing. Very often that's inappropriate, just as inappropriate for the reasons that Amanda gave. But you do need to look, when you're setting the range and domain, that you are setting them appropriately if you want use to be able to happen. And very often that means thinking wider than the application for which the ontology is originally developed. And that's one of the challenges. That's what I had to say.
Great, thanks. Johannes?
So, yeah, I guess the whole topic is quite difficult to answer. But my view on that, I mean, I have a different view on that, but from what my experience here is that, I mean, our process in developing these solutions based on semantic technologies is really agile, as I said, and it's intertwined. So the ontology and application development is quite intertwined. So it's a mixture of starting from the data, then adding some or extending the ontologies and so on. But, I mean, why we are so quick in developing solution is basically that's this concept of extensibility is extending the ontology on the fly is really quick. And you see, like, also the end users see have intermediate results and see something happening on different levels. For example, editing the data, visualization, but as well as querying, as I said. And so for us, it's already hard to teach really end users being sometimes only experienced in software development to teach them semantic technologies and then also to go, of course, in these all these kinds of difficulties in ontology engineering aspects. So from that point of view, it's most often that it's just intermediate value for the end user and also for the solution. But I agree in some situations they rise, especially when it comes then to integrate with different domains and to further bigger extensions when it comes to difficulties.
Okay. Thank you very much, Johannes. Are there any other questions from the audience? So maybe while you are thinking about your next question, I have one more related to Oscar's presentation. I saw, Oscar, that you made heavy use of office tools like spreadsheets, but I haven't seen the idea of a concept map in your presentation. Personally, my experience with concept maps is very positive, not as a first step for, you know, setting the language and what to put in there, but to easily and interactively help people visualize what they're really talking about. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, probably I have not included it, just because, well, I mean, to some extent I didn't think of it, and also because it was not really the cause of a deadlock. Yeah, I mean, probably it was oriented to how I was configuring the presentation. A common way of working in my case is normally that I concentrate a lot on the Excel files, on working on with Office tools, just because people are very used to that, and because it allows like a very easy way of working in terms of like working collaboratively, but from different places, so that people do not have to be in there. But for instance, in this open data portal project, it's a collaboration that we are running now. We meet each other around once every 3 weeks or something like that. And concept maps are, so let's say that, it's easier because if you go into tooling for using concept maps on the web, again, they exist. But people feel very constrained because it's an app. My experience is that they only feel confident with the, or comfortable with the tools that they normally use every day. So we use it on the whiteboard, and whiteboard is perfectly okay. Yeah, or flip chart or whatever. Well, at the very beginning, it's mostly Excel.
I couldn't hear your last sentence, but I think the rest was clear. Thank you very much for your remarks. There's another question from Michael Gruninger that I think is very interesting one. He asked about Johannes' presentations, what specific ontologies have been designed with the framework, and even more interesting, whether some of the developed ontologies could be reused across clients. Johannes, could you address that question?
So, yeah, for example, as I said, our eCloud Manager ontology is the most prominent example. This has been reused successfully with different customers and industry, and then also being extended for more specific use cases or within the data center domain. But this ontology has been proven so far quite successful in adoption in that specific data center domain. So there we also integrate with some, of course, we also have files in there, for example, to cover basic, organizational aspects, as you see in this, I think, in the third slide. And this is a good example. Does it answer your question? Or?
Yes. Thank you very much. Okay, we have like 10 more minutes left. Are there any other questions?
I would like to react, sorry that I haven't raised my hand. I would like to react to something that has been commented by Simon. I think that he's around there yet, still there. He was commenting on the difficulty from going from competency questions to user stories. I think that was related to one of the comments that I was doing on the agile approach that I was taking. And in fact, I mean, I think that he was going the other way around. Like, I have a user story, and then I select the competency questions. And how do I select the competency questions? Just to share what I do. Normally what I do is that I don't think about the user stories beforehand, but based on the competency questions or semi-formal competency questions that have arisen during the first iterations, we group them and we generate the user story from there. I'm not sure, I mean, whether it is a good approach or a bad approach, but this is the one that I'm taking, and it normally works. I don't know whether you have any comment on that, because you were commenting. Okay, good.
Simon?
The agile methods that are typically in the Scrum type case, the user story is the starting point for developing the competent questions or the behavioral tests, which are the equivalent. That is, like, you start off with what it is that sub use case. Particular, a little problem that is supposed to be solvable in this particular sprint, and then from that you through conversations you work out what the how you can actually tell or whether that need is being met, and getting more details. It's going from, like, the 3x5 cards to the behavior-driven tests that just look to see if you can model represent what you're saying it is, what you were supposed to be able to model, or whether you can infer what you were supposed to infer. And but it's starting from a need rather than from a being able to test whether some unspecified need is being met, which is why I was wondering whether it was going backwards. And and I just wondered if you had comments on that, like how you related a being able to achieve a task using ontologies and the ontology development.
Mm-hmm.
I'll shut up now. On purpose.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, I think that the, I mean, in our case, it's mostly that the, let's say the user story comes out from the set of competency questions that we are selecting. It's kind of a very strange manner of working. I mean, I acknowledge it, and that, I mean, is one of those things that, I mean, agile methods should be adapted to whatever you think that, I mean, it works. Yeah. In general, but I mean, from my point of view, you define the task when you are doing the grouping of the competency questions, and then, I mean, it's basically the idea is that the user story would be always, I want to represent these, and this is more or less the context of what I want to represent. So it's a way to encode it. We don't ever in fact even like describe exactly a user story from there, but. But I think, I mean, that the context that is given to that is more or less enough in order to set the context of what people have to work on during that sprint.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. Maybe one last question to Daval and also Oscar. So what I really like is that we also talked about cultural differences, right? Oscar made the point of language, right, which seems obvious, but it's often forgotten, right, so that how should you reuse an ontology, which happens to be in English, right, if the community is speaking Spanish. And I also like the cultural examples that Daval made. So could the two of you comment on how far we really are in terms of methodologies to address those cultural variabilities?
Not far at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I have no idea yet about how to best solve it. Of course, I mean, in the context of our group, we have been working on on models to represent multilinguality. We are working, we are talking about multilingual ontologies. But I mean, let's say that that's a different context. I mean, because we are mostly focused about linguistic resources and so on. So it's like a different focus. This is a very simple problem. I want to be connected to the, I don't know, the organization ontology from the W3C. But the organization ontology has all the IDs in English, even if it has the labels in Spanish. I'm not even talking about the cultural differences about, I mean, for instance, that the administrative geography is completely different in every single country, yeah, which is a completely different problem that we are all very aware of and that we all know that it is difficult to solve, yeah, in a very general manner. But just with this, I have no idea. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this as a potential source of ideas on how other people have solved this problem. Yeah, if you have ever come up with it. My feeling is always let's work in Spanish and let's try to connect later or to link later to the terms in English because they will ensure some form of interoperability at some point in time.
Thank you very much. Daval, if you are still online, maybe you can give us your thoughts. You will have to press *7 to unmute yourself.
Yes, yes. Thanks for reminding me. I was talking and not unmuting. I think in terms of, I'm coming from the perspective of modeling various aspects of culture, and I think the answer is obvious there. We are quite far. You know, even though we have designed something which is probably very, very minute of the whole scale of culture. Even for the, you know, we scoped it for interpersonal communication, but we ruled out lots of things there. We just focused on nonverbal communication, gesture and things like that, but we just ruled out verbal communication, which is language and things like that, which is a big part of interpersonal skills and then obviously culture. So, I mean, there are lots of aspects which are not covered, and we it's a very interesting domain, but we are quite far. I've got Vanya with me, Vanya Dimitrova. So we are using the same phone basically, and she was the coordinator of the AMREAL project. She also worked on the research bit I presented, but she was also coordinator. So she has something to add. So I'll give way to her.
Yeah, I recently, hello everybody, I've been listening all the talks and discussions with great interest. Just to answer to this, we've always been asked this question, culture is messy, and in our team, for example, in the AMREAL project, we had two other semantic web groups. One was the Technical University Delft, and the other one was from the Trinity College Dublin. And we, within ourselves, quite often were discussing, is really culture ready to enter into it when it's so messy and so ill-defined? Is culture really a domain for computer scientists? Isn't culture still a domain for social scientists to sort out, you know, the debates between themselves? I will leave it as an open question. So I think that we dared, we entered, but we have just made a small step. We certainly have not solved all the questions as a social scientist or a philosopher would want us to solve. So in a way, we've been quite pragmatic. But what works at the moment, we can say, the problem and also the opportunity with culture is the diversity. So why I'm saying is the opportunity, because, obviously you cannot keep on asking people you cannot find the experts to tell you all that richness of diversity. You need to go and get into the crowd wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. I think this is a great last comment. Culture is a feature, not a bug, and all this heterogeneity coming out of it. Thank you very much for our three speakers. Thank you very much for Peter Yim and all the organizers of the Ontology Summit for making this possible. And thank you very much for the audience for staying with us and raising your interesting questions and comments also in the chat. That's it. I hope you enjoyed it and see you in the next session next week. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.